Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Malcolm Benji's podcast. I'm Benji, and I'm without Malk at the moment, as this is my retrospective of 2013. It's nearing midnight on the 30th of December, and unfortunately, Malk's wife won't let him out at this time of night, at this time of year. Apparently, he's got better things to do, like sleeping and so on and so forth. So I'm going to do a solo rundown of my cinematic year, talking about all the films which I saw in 2013. Now, as with previous Benji's retrospectives, I'm only going to be talking about films which were released in cinemas this year and which I saw for the first time this year. So any re-releases that I had already seen, I'm not talking about. And any films that came out in the cinema last year that I saw for the first time this year, I'm not talking about. And any films that came out in the cinema this year that I haven't seen yet, I won't be talking about. There are a few films in here which were re-released this year, older films, which I saw for the first time this year, and I have included those. The two that stick out to me are Chinatown and Grave of the Fireflies by Studio Ghibli. So I will be talking about those films, but that's it. Films that were released in cinemas in 2013, which I saw in 2013. It's a chronological list. Some films will be getting more playtime than others, depending on how much impact they had on me, positive or negative. There's a fairly sort of broad spectrum of indies to blockbusters, to dramas, to sci-fi, to, character-based films, to special effects-based films. We've tried to keep it broad this year, the wife and I. And so there should be quite a nice spread. Although, having said that, obviously, with cinema being the way it is, you do kind of tend to go for the ones with the bigger special effects budgets and wait for the other ones, the sort of the more character-driven ones to come out on DVD. It's not a great way to live, but where we live in the world, with a lack of access to decent cinemas, at least until this year, when our local flea pit got upgraded, it's kind of the way you have to do things. So that's if it seems a bit blockbuster heavy, then that's kind of why. Also, you know, as much as I'd like to be a pretentious art house indie, you know, film buff, I'm not. I like blockbusters, even if it's just to whinge at them. Without further preamble, let's kick off. And the first film of 2013 is The Impossible, starring Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor, as well as a bunch of Muppets whose names I don't know, but who actually were pretty decent performers. It's a film which recounts the true tale of a family who were caught in the Boxing Day tsunami and the troubles thereafter. It tells about the family splitting up, kind of getting back together, life, death, people, humanity coming together in the face of such disaster. It's a film which it kind of, when you look at the trailers, it kind of plays as a twee, happy-go-lucky, beautiful family overcoming adversity in the face of incredible odds. But it's not. It's actually quite a harrowing drama. And there are moments when there are characters who disappear, for one reason or another, be it death or just they're out of the story, and we're left with the characters who this impacts on, and it's very, very harrowing. Whether you're a parent or not, you know, we've all been children to parents, and you can empathize with the characters when they lose certain people and they have to work around not having them anymore. It's very, very well performed. Some of the special effects, certainly in terms of the tsunami itself, were very affecting because it focuses on the characters and on their responses and reactions. It's not sort of disaster porn, to coin a phrase, or to use a coin phrase, which it kind of could have been in the hands of a less able director. It's not particularly flashily directed. It's certainly not badly directed. It doesn't glorify the special effects. Some of the makeup effects, certainly on the wounds, are very effective. And if you're squeamish, you might want to turn your head away at certain points. Again, this is one of those cases where, however gory film can be, it maybe isn't as bad as it was in real life. I'm glad I wasn't there. I can say that. And the film handles it very well. Again, it's not lingered upon. It's just, it's there, it's shocking for the brief moment, and then it kind of implies a lot through the use of camera angles, through the use of focus on a dirty bandage or a spreading black line up a vein. It uses subtle cues to great impact when highlighting the threat that the characters face. It was a good film. It's not one that I would necessarily rush out to go and watch again, although I am very glad I saw it and would definitely recommend, if anyone's interested in, you know, that event or in natural disasters being handled in a realistic and mature fashion, it's definitely one to watch. And it's one of those ones that will sort of restore your faith in humanity, not in a It's a Wonderful World kind of way, but in a realistic and believable kind of way. Next up on the list is Chinatown, the famous Jack Nicholson, Roman Polanski murder mystery, whodunit. It's one of the classic neo-noir films, and there's little I can say that hasn't been said before. It really is one of the classics of cinema. All I can say is I can't believe that I got to my 30s without seeing this film, and my word, is it good? Does it live up to the hype? It certainly does. Jack Nicholson in a tour de force performance. The direction is taut. It's thrilling. The twist at the end, even though I kind of knew from reading various film books, I knew what the twist was going to be, it's still very, very unpleasant to experience. It's still very affecting. It's still very engaging. It's a great film. I'm going to stop there because better people have said more about it than I could possibly. Next up is Gangster Squad. With Josh Brolin and Sean Penn, and this was an interesting one. It had a lot of the makings of a very, very good film, and it didn't quite gel together like you wanted it to, or like I wanted it to. It kind of looked like someone had watched a lot of gangster films from the 50s, 60s, 70s, all the way up to Untouchables. De Palma, Brian De Palma's Untouchables, and kind of made a cover version or a best of. You know, all the hard talking guys are there, all the Tommy guns are there, all the hats and coats are there. Everything sort of fits into place, but it never quite hangs together as a solid film by itself. Some reasonably good performances. Sean Penn is good. Josh Brolin's very good, Emma Stone's very good, and Ryan Gosling's very good. They're all very good, none of them career bests, but they're all very good. It just doesn't hang together the way that this kind of film should, the way that The Untouchables does, as a sort of a quintessential neo-film noir. Next up is Les Misérables, Tom Hooper's take on the classic stage musical based on the doorstop novel by Victor Hugo. And this is a film which... it's a very divisive film, even within my own head. There are bits of it where I think it is a resounding success. And as a fan of the musical, I loved what they did with it on screen. And there are bits where I just can't believe they changed what they changed, why they changed what they changed. You know, taking this great cinematic musical, a musical that should, by all accounts, work very well on an epic scope, and then reducing it in certain parts to less than that. A lot of the fault hangs with a lot of the fault and a lot of the praise hangs with the director's decision to really bring the camera in to the actors. You don't really need to be able to act all that well to do Les Mis. You need to be a good singer and a fair actor, I think. Maybe you disagree with me. If so, by all means, put comments on the post. But I think that's a fair assertion. It's not really an actory kind of musical. And so to bring the camera in to see Hugh Jackman really sort of pop his veins in his head and really sort of rest those tears out and really cry in some of his earlier songs is a really bold decision, and one that I think works tremendously well when it works. The absolute standout, and I have no shame in following many other people from saying this, it's a bit of a cliche and for a very good reason, Anne Hathaway's solo song, I Dreamed a Dream, is just heartbreakingly stunning. It is one take. It's close up on Anne Hathaway, on her poor, grizzled, dirty face. And it is heartbreaking. And it just shows the confidence in Anne Hathaway that the director had. And it shows the confidence that he has that he doesn't need to muddy it up with chops and edits and cuts and long shots and wide shots. And it works beautifully. The same happens later on. And it doesn't work as well. When Fantine and Marius have their little duet and Eponine's there and watching them and she loves Marius and it's a love triangle kind of thing, you don't ever sort of understand or see what's going on with them. It kind of stays too close on them at this point. Whereas a few wider shots could have helped maybe to develop the relationship visually. So there's good points and bad points in Tom Hooper's sort of intimate lensing of those moments. There's a lot of very interesting wide moments, a lot of very interesting sort of long shots of Parisian CGI, Parisian landscapes and French landscapes, and they're stunning. It's beautiful to watch. It just could have maybe done with a bit less of a formulaic, here's the big CGI shot, now here's loads of close-ups of actors singing, now here's another big CGI shot. If it mixed it up visually, it could have just been a bit more arresting. One of the major faults with the film, and it could stem from the fact that Javert, the antagonist, is my favourite character and has my favourite songs, is that Russell Crowe is horribly, horribly miscast. And I hope I never get a phone thrown at me by him, but he's not a good singer. He's just not. And how he got into this role just smacks of Hollywood politics so much more than decent casting, and it makes me unhappy for the industry. He's a rock singer. He's in a rock band, and what he's doing, trying to sing show tunes, especially deeply emotional show tunes that, you know, you have to be a fair actor and a good singer to get away with. He's a good actor. He's not a good singer. You know, you can't mix and match in that way, unfortunately. And he just falls flat on many, many of his songs. Plus, he doesn't really sort of come across as the stand-up, forthright police officer. He doesn't have that sort of that dogged determination in his performance. He plays Russell Crowe, essentially. It could be Robin Hood chasing Jean Valjean. It could be Maximus chasing Jean Valjean. There's not enough range in what he does these days, unfortunately. So there are a lot of really good moments, a lot of poor moments. Helena Bonham Carter's good. Borat isn't so much. It's hit and miss. If you love the musical, I think you'll find this to be a worthwhile watch, but it won't replace the musical in your heart. And if you haven't seen the musical, well, what are you doing? Go and watch this. It's amazing. Next up is Quentin Tarantino's Western / Southern / cowboy film, Django Unchained, starring Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, and Leonardo DiCaprio. And this is... I'm a big Tarantino fan, and so when you get a film like this, which has got a lot of hype built up around it, it's either going to live up to expectations, like, for example, Kill Bill, or really let you down, like Death Proof. And fortunately, this is far more the former. It fits in the same kind of world. It's not quite as stylized as Kill Bill, but it's far more stylized than your Reservoir Dogs and your Pulp Fictions. It doesn't play with history quite like Inglourious Basterds does, or maybe I'm just not as familiar with that portion of history, I'm not sure. But it's a very, very, very good film. Excellent performances, wonderful, wonderful Western tropes in there to really sort of get your Sergio Leone's up. Brilliant storytelling, phenomenal climax. DiCaprio has never been better since maybe Catch Me If You Can. It's a phenomenal film. Christoph Waltz is just... he should be doing films like this. People should be writing roles like this for him all the time rather than having him do Green Hornet and rubbish like that. It's a phenomenal film. I love Jamie Foxx. I think he's very, very good. It was going to be Will Smith in the role, and I don't know how Will Smith would have fared, but I can't see him. I mean, obviously Will Smith and Jamie Foxx, both Oscar-winning actors. I just can't see how he would have fared in this role. Whereas Jamie Foxx just fits it like a glove, the sort of the naive, wide-eyed slave who finds his freedom and goes on a quest, a pure-hearted quest to find his wife, and then becomes just this badass gunslinger in the meantime. It's a really cool film. I don't want to get into the sort of the politics of it. I mean, we all know slavery's bad, and the fact that Tarantino goes from quite vivid depictions of and quite visceral depictions of slaves being tortured to quite heightened Western gunfights. It doesn't matter. It's a good film. It's all used to good effect. And if you can ignore the sort of the history and the politics around it, and just look at it for the filmmaking craft, it's amazing. It's really, really good. And that final gunfight stands up there with Open Range as one of the best final gunfights I've ever seen. It's so entertaining. And you really feel for the characters. It's brilliant. Next up is VHS, horror film compilation with a sort of a loosely plotted hang together. It's quite good. It's quite good. It's not maybe worth £20 for DVD, but it's worth a couple of quid for a rental. The short films vary from all right to quite, you know, effective horror. The bits that sort of the bookends and the sort of the linking sequences aren't really very good, but they're not supposed to be, I don't suppose. There's a VHS 2 that's either come out this year or coming out next year. I'm not quite sure how it stands in the UK, but it's worth a check, especially if you're a horror fan. If you're not a horror fan, don't check it out, because there's nothing in the way of characterization or plot or anything like that. It's just, you know, exercises in horror. So if you're a horror fan, then yeah, go and see it. Next up, Lincoln, Steven Spielberg's big film of the year. It's not the best Spielberg film of all time. That's still Raiders. It's not the best Spielberg drama of all time. That still, I think, stands with Schindler's List. But it is a return to form for Spielberg after things like Crystal Skull, Terminal, you know, things like that. His sort of mediocre years. This kind of marks a return to form. It's a beautifully done film, both deeply character-driven and also epic in terms of its history, its import, its place in cinematic history. It's certainly the biggest modern Lincoln biopic. Certainly not the only one, but it's Daniel Day-Lewis is marvelous as Abraham Lincoln. He's really, really good. The whole cast absolutely stand out as extremely, extremely good. The script is marvelous. The directing, it's unfussy in a way that Malk and I discuss quite a lot. But it's so self-assured. When the camera lingers on him in a darkened room, it's all dark because it's dark outside. They're all wearing black. It's all dark brown, you know, varnished furniture. And we just sort of see this face standing out as he delivers an anecdote about something and then rounds it off with a point. And Day-Lewis, you know, doesn't sort of go all out, all over the top with it. He just stays so in character. It's marvellous. It is a tour de force. Very, very, very effective drama. Masterful filmmaking. Like I say, not the best of anything, anyone's career, but certainly up there in the upper echelons of everyone's career. Next up is Zero Dark Thirty from Catherine Bigelow, the director of The Hurt Locker, the only female director ever to win an Oscar at this point by the end of 2013. And it's easy to see why. She's really, really, really good. She takes the camera and she does things in it that Green Zone and Bourne do. And the other sort of war documentaries do, Welcome to Sarajevo and things like that. And she just masterfully uses that camera. She masterfully uses the edit. Jessica Chastain is very, very effective as the woman. She kind of channels a little bit of Carrie from Homeland, a little bit of Jodie Foster from Silence of the Lambs. She's that strong woman, directed by a woman in a film, developed by a woman. It's not like a male tokenistic strong woman like Lara Croft. It is an actual character who's doing a job very, very well, and she's a woman. The film just absolutely hangs on Chastain's shoulders. She's marvellous. She's fantastic as the central character. The first sort of two-thirds of the film, maybe three-quarters even, are the hunt for bin Laden, which is kind of what the film was going to be in its developmental stages before they actually caught bin Laden. And the last quarter of the film is the assault on his compound, the planning, the execution, and the sort of payoff of that. And it's beautifully done. Again, a lot of sort of shaky cam, a lot of sort of verite in there, sort of handheld cameras, a lot of rifle cam. It's never an action film. It's always a very, very well represented sort of look at how these operations would be pulled off. You know, there's never any sort of Arnie style explosions and two machine guns, guns akimbo, nothing like that. It's very, it's very well thought out in terms of the operation, not just the scene. No one is in there for the glory. They go in there like professionals. They do their job. They come back out. You can see that the filmmakers have been integrally involved with the people who carried out the mission. And the authenticity of it just stands out. And it's a really good film, a very, very tense film. And the climax, the emotional climax, certainly, of the film, in which we see Jessica Chastain's character sort of realize that 10 years worth of work has been done and it's a success, and how she comes to terms with the fact that it's become a success with the death of a man and the deaths of many, many people between 9/11 and then. It's phenomenal. It's really, really good. Very, very good. I'd certainly say it's an unmissable film of 2013. Next up is Flight, which is Denzel Washington and John Goodman, the story of a pilot who, drunk and stoned, saves a plane from essentially crashing and saves a bunch of lives. So then the next step is he a hero, and how long is it till they find out that he's not a hero, he's actually a very, very lucky drug addict. Robert Zemeckis' return to live action, and he really should stay in live action. This is so much better than the Polar Express and Beowulf and all those CGI experiments that surely have passed their time now. It's a very assured film. It's a very good film. Phenomenal performances from the leads. Denzel Washington, predictably very, very good. John Goodman, predictably very, very good. The story is engaging and engrossing. It's well worth a watch. Maybe not the Oscar sort of standout that it became, or maybe I'm just being a bit too harsh because, you know, everyone's won Oscars already in that cast and crew. So definitely worth a watch. Good film. And the key sort of CGI sequence at the beginning where the plane actually starts to crash is heart-thumping. It's equally as exciting as anything from any sort of air-based action film that you'll see. You know, just the truth of what it's based on. And it's loosely based on a story or a few incidents where similar things have happened, but it's very authentically done, very realistically done, and it is gripping. Okay, next up, Warm Bodies, the story of a zombie who meets a girl, falls in love with a girl, and starts to want to be a better zombie. Nicholas Hoult is very, very good. The rest of the film is kind of an average, maybe better than average, rom-com built around a very, very interesting idea. It has kind of a saccharine ending. I'm not spoiling too much by saying that, you know, it's saccharine towards the end. I mean, what the actual ending is still a mystery, even though this should really come with a spoiler alert. But it's too conventional in the rom and the com, and the zombie idea never really plays out quite as well as it could or it should. It should have been more of a black comedy, I think. It would have worked better as a black comedy with a woman falling in love with a zombie, and is it necrophilia or isn't it, you know, as his personality comes out. Because over the course of the film, basically, he becomes less zombie. He becomes less disgusting, and that kind of, it deadens the impact. I don't want to see a film of a woman kissing a putrid walking corpse, but it would have been more effective as a zombie romantic comedy than it was. It's certainly far, far below Shaun of the Dead and Zombieland as zomcoms, but it's above average for the whole rom-com genre. Next up is Wreck-It Ralph, Disney's sort of one of Disney's CG takes of the year. Wreck-It Ralph was all right. The vocal performances are very good from John C. Reilly and Sarah Silverman. The story is much better than the film. The story of a video game character who skips out, or the video game villain who skips out of his game because he wants to be a hero. That has got so much potential. And, you know, owing to the need for a A to B to C plot, it kind of scuppers itself because this could have gone on and on and on. It could have been a series, it could have been a mini-series, a short series, you know, it had a lot of potential to be so many things, an experimental short rather than a full-length feature, and as a full-length feature, it needs to be its own thing, and it gets lost halfway through into a very traditional plot and becomes a very traditional sort of Disney hero triumphing against adversity. It could have been so much more. Ideas abound, brilliant animation, good comic moments, but it just gets too samey from the middle onwards. Next up is Cloud Atlas, one of the most divisive films of the year. Is it a masterpiece? Is it a train wreck? Personally, I sit in the masterpiece camp. I think it is absolutely stunning. The fact that it jumps from narrative to narrative with different characters playing different roles in each narrative, the fact that it's two different directors working on essentially five or six different short films that each share themes and tonal ideas, it doesn't sound like as much of a mess as I'm making it sound. No, it isn't as much of a mess as I'm making it sound, I should say. It's a really, really assured film. Visually, it is stunning, without being over the top like the Matrix sequels and like Speed Racer. The plot, coming from the book, it's sort of adapted from the book, so the plot doesn't follow the book exactly in terms of the plot points. But it kind of follows the themes through. We engage with the characters, whether it's Tom Hanks playing a scientist in the 70s or a post-apocalyptic jungle hunter in Hawaii in the far future. It's phenomenally good. It's a really, really good film. To say any more would be to confuse myself and to spoil the film for anyone who hasn't seen it yet. But I will say that Cloud Atlas is definitely one to watch. Even if you end up hating it, I don't apologise for that, because it still deserves an audience, whether it's an overly critical audience or an underly critical audience. Next up is Mama. Again, Jessica Chastain, a horror film produced by Guillermo del Toro, and it's not one iota as good as I wanted it to be or as I thought it would be. The first half of it is very, very effective, creepy. It's about two young girls who are stranded out in the woods when their dad kills them. Well, ostensibly kills himself after murdering the mother. And then they're raised by something, which when they're found in a feral state and brought back to their family, comes with them. And that's the eponymous Mama. And it's a brilliant conceit. It's a wonderful idea, the fact that this ghost, this haunted presence is not the bad guy. It's the protector of the girls. And that would have been a far more interesting idea if they'd stuck with that than what it eventually became, which was, a more traditional ghost story, and it loses a lot when it becomes that, which is a shame. The acting is very good. Jessica Chastain is very good. Jamie Lannister is very good, and the girls are very good. But it's not as good a story as the first half of it, and certainly the trailer and the pre-release buzz led me to believe. Next up, Oz the Great and Powerful. No. It's not bad. There's no bit of it that's actively bad. It's just Sam Raimi doing Hollywood Sam Raimi, when what he should be doing is going back and doing indie Sam Raimi in the shape of Army of Darkness 2. It's twee, it's over the top, it's oversaturated, the colours are too much. It reminds me a lot of the trailers for Tim Burton's later films, and we don't need more of that, we really don't. If you like Wizard of Oz, just go and watch Wizard of Oz again, and if you want to see something different, go and see Return to Oz, a much, much superior spin-off than this. Next up, Robot and Frank, an indie sci-fi starring Frank Langella and a robot, about a man, an older man struggling with senility, and his family get him a robot helper. It's set in the near future, and him and the robot become good friends, and they go off and onto sort of comical misadventures. It's not as funny as the trailers make it seem, and it's not as heart-wrenching a drama as you would perhaps want it to be, but it's very, very sweet. It's a very, very good film. It's Susan Sarandon and Frank Langella's relationship in there. She's a librarian and he's a frequent visitor. It's very, very sweet. The twists and the turns in the plot, sort of the way it all comes together at the end, doesn't hit you as hard as you'd want it to emotionally, which maybe is a bit more realistic, I'm not sure. But it's very effective, very, very well written, very sweet, very interesting sci-fi. It's sci-fi as a view of what the world might turn out to be, which is very interesting. It's a good film, and it's a low budget indie film, and I think that the filmmaker there deserves support. So if you haven't seen it, go and rent it or pay for it somehow, so he gets to make more movies. Next up, Side Effects, psychological thriller, starring Rooney Mara from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Yeah, it's really good. It's really good. It's a whodunit. It's a did she or didn't she? You know, she kills her husband, quite near the beginning, and you're led to believe it was her, and then you're led to believe it was the drugs, the side effects of the drugs she was on, hence side effects, and then you're led to believe it was her again, and it sort of twists and turns, and it's very effective. It's good. It's well acted. It's a good film. Well worth seeing. Next up, Jack the Giant Slayer, Bryan Singer's big budget fairy tale. Again, it suffers from just being a bit too cliched, a bit too unoriginal. Nicholas Holt, again, as the lead, is good. Ian McShane brings very good villain. Bill Nighy is amazing as the voice of the main villain. Did I say Ian McShane's villain? He's not. He's the sort of the heroine's father. He's the king of the land. It's a perfectly acceptable film. It's kind of like in the same quality vein as National Treasure and things like that. You know, there's nothing wrong with it per se, but it doesn't really bring enough to the world. It doesn't do enough world building to really make you care about what's going on. So it ends up being a bit of a computer game in the end, with an underdeveloped world in which these great epic battles are happening. So there's some interesting stuff going on, but it's not Bryan Singer at his best. Okay, next up, The Host. Saoirse Ronan in the story of alien invasion from the woman who brought you Twilight. It's not as bad as Twilight, either the film or the book. The idea is much better than the execution. There's a lot of very, very good moments in it, mostly around Saoirse Ronan and her duality as the alien inside her body and as her original personality. Again, it's one of those things that could have been done better as a miniseries, where we focus more on the character and what it means to be an alien on Earth, what it means to be an invader in someone's body when that person's still there, rather than, you know, a cat and mouse thriller that never quite lives up to it. I love the idea that the aliens have fixed the Earth, so therefore, are they the bad guys? Well, no, not really. It's like with The Day the Earth Stood Still, the Keanu Reeves remake. That's a really, really good idea about the fact that wiping out humans is what the good guys need to do to save the Earth. My favorite quote from that film is, if the Earth dies, humans die. If humans die, the Earth survives. And that's a sci-fi conceit which I think, you know, is humanized too much in the sense that there's always a way out of it. It's always humans are the good guys. We're the ones that are going to... No, we're not. You know, we're destroying the planet. And I want to see a sci-fi film where the aliens that are trying to wipe us out are the good guys. And the host kind of went there and then fluffed it. So there we go. Next up is Oblivion. Tom Cruise film. Again, it's one of those films where it was a lot better, I think, than sort of the press gave it credit for, but it still wasn't quite... Or was it? I don't know. It did what it set out to do very, very, very well. You know, the sort of Tom Cruise is very, very good as the sort of the blue-collar hero turned action hero. The rest of the cast around him is fine. There's not a huge cast. The special effects are stunning. The action sequences are really good. It's a story about a bunch of aliens who come to Earth this time and are doing worse things than the human race. And so the human race fight them back and then end up on a blasted planet and Tom Cruise is left behind. And then there's a whole bunch of plot that happens. And it's all very, very interesting. It's all very good. But it's not great. It's not sort of classic sci-fi. It's not Cloud Atlas, you know. It doesn't sort of bring a whole new level to your understanding of what you're watching any point. It's just, if anything, it descends into standard action film towards the end of the film, and it could have been more about the ideas. So it's fun and engaging while you're watching it, but it doesn't sort of stay with you afterwards. Next up is the remake of The Evil Dead, which is... gorier, flasher, sleeker, not as good, not as inventive, far more po-faced and for the Evil Dead, you know, it can't be. In a post-Cabin in the Woods world, you can't do a Cabin in the Woods film without it being at least a little bit ironic or tongue-in-cheek. And Evil Dead takes an ironic, tongue-in-cheek property and makes it very serious, and it kind of fails on that count. The trailer promised more in terms of body horror, in terms of, you know, mutilation and self-mutilation and possession and those kinds of things, and the film doesn't really live up to that. It's more sort of gore, the physical aspects of gore rather than the psychological aspects of body horror, which is what I wanted it to be. Performances are fine, and word is that in the future there'll be an Ash meets the hero of this one team up, and I'll be fine to see that, but I prefer Ash. I prefer the sort of the tongue-in-cheek, the Three Stooges meets, you know, Dario Argento. I prefer that kind of horror when it comes to my Evil Dead. Iron Man 3 is the next one up, and for me this was possibly the blockbuster of the year. Well, maybe not. There's some later on in the year that were really good, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Iron Man 3 I thought was really, really, really good. Was it what you wanted following the Avengers? A lot of people know it wasn't. Was it what you wanted following, you know, leading up to Thor 2 or whatever? No, it wasn't. But was it a good film with good performances, an interesting plot? Did it live up to the promise of Iron Man 1? Yes, it did, I think. Absolutely. Tony Stark, as played by Robert Downey Jr., is very, very interesting as a character, both his arrogance and his power and his sort of anxiety and his sort of lack of surety in himself after the events of the Avengers. It's brilliant. It's very, very well done. It's Shane Black, so of course it takes place in the snow at some point. And then Shane Black, while not being the flashiest of blockbuster directors, certainly knows about dialogue and certainly knows about character. And we get wonderful moments between Stark and Rhodey. We get some brilliant moments with Aldrich Killian, the villain, before he reveals himself as a sort of a bigger villain than we think. Ben Kingsley is superb in the film, very, very menacing in those early VTs. And yeah, it's good. It's just, it's very, very good. It's not flawless, but I'd be hard pressed to sort of really, you know, tweak out those flaws in a few minutes. It was good. I really enjoyed it. If you like blockbusters, if you like comic book movies, this is the movie to beat this year, I think. Which brings us into the next film, Star Trek Into Darkness, which, based on the trailers, was going to be my blockbuster of the year. And it failed spectacularly, not because of poor direction, because it's very, very well directed. There's the moment when the Enterprise dips below the clouds, it's flying towards the ground, then it comes back up and the music goes into crescendo. And I don't care who you are, I don't care whether you love Star Trek or hate Star Trek, you pump the air with your fist at that point. It's just so well done. But the script around it really, really, really needed work, and it didn't have it. I'm going to ruin, spoil, whatever here. Benedict Cumberbatch as Khan. It would have been so much better if he'd not been Khan, if he'd been John Harrison, a Starfleet agent who had gone against Starfleet, and we had more sympathy for him because he's got legitimate reasons for doing it, but he's still a terrorist, blah, 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 blah. So much more interesting than, my name is Khan. And from then on, you're just ticking off the Star Trek II references. And it doesn't live up to Star Trek II. It's not as good a film. J.J. Abrams is a very good director, and I'm very much looking forward to Star Wars 7. But he's not as good as Nicholas Meyer. He's not. He doesn't have that same ability with pacing and editing. And you know, Benedict Cumberbatch is fine as an actor. You know, he's not the best actor since sliced bread, like a lot of Sherlock fanboys seem to think he is. But he's fine. But he's not a Ricardo Montalban. It just doesn't make any sense that he would be Khan. He's white. He's not sort of Asian or even Hispanic or anything. How is he a Superman? What does his Superman blood do? It's all ridiculous. It's all very, very silly. And that's where I lose it. It was great up until that point. You know, the Kirk and Spock were great, and Scotty. I love Simon Pegg, and the special effects were good, and the opening mission was intriguing, and it was all holding me very, very much in intrigue. And then suddenly it just became... All right, on to Grave of the Fireflies. Studio Ghibli, animation from the 80s about two young children who are trying to live in the blown-out streets of Japan during World War II. It's beautifully animated. It's heartbreaking. I wept like a child following this film, and if anyone watches this film and doesn't, then you are a robot, my friend. It's a great film. It's brilliant. It's beautiful. I don't want to say too much because there's not that much to say except, you know, it's well animated. It's historically, it's a historical film. You know, it's not a kiddie cartoon Disney-fied film. It's very much an animated drama, and it's heartbreaking and beautiful. If you haven't seen it, go and see it. Don't show your kids. Next up, Byzantium, Neil Jordan's latest vampire opus, or I should say Sanguinian, or whatever they call themselves. They're not really vampires, but they are. They don't have the fangs and they turn into bats, but they do drink blood and they are immortal. I love this film. I really enjoyed Byzantium very, very much. It took the vampire subgenre of horror and it did something new and interesting with it. It's a couple of women, and they're vampires essentially, and they're basically trying to outwit vampire society and live on the run. While still being able to feed and still not being killed by humans, it's brilliant. Again, Saoirse Ronan as the younger of the two, and Gemma Arterton as the older of the two, they are phenomenally good in this film, and the film itself hangs together really well. It's an interesting horror film, or it's an interesting horror drama, I should say. And I don't want to say it's the best horror film ever, because it's not. It's not the best character drama ever, because it's not. But for horror fans, for fans of vampire films, for fans of a sort of horror or horror drama, not even action horror, because there's not that much action in it. It's definitely worth a watch. I don't know how much money it made when it came out. I don't think it was a huge success, but it really should have been. You know, when you consider, I'm looking at things like Mama here, which were a big hit, but a very big disappointment. Byzantium should have done a lot better than that. Speaking of the next film, Man of Steel. Again, one of those really divisive films for me where it split me in my own head between loving bits of it and hating bits of it. I really liked Amy Adams. I really liked Superman, I forget, Henry Cavill. Zod is amazing. The guy that plays Zod, again, his name will come to me in a second, the guy from Boardwalk Empire, he's really, really good as the villain, because you believe that he's doing it for a purpose, but he's also really intimidating and scary. He's phenomenal. And yet, it's written in a silly way. You know, the last fight doesn't make a lot of sense, and it's the destruction at the end is what's been hearkened to a lot since the film came out, and how it's far too much and blah, blah, blah. And it strikes me as you know, 12 years on from 9/11, we can suddenly start making films about cities being destroyed again. And while I don't have a problem with that per se, I just think it's done beyond what needs to be done. It doesn't need to be that destructive. It doesn't need to be that big. Just because you can do it doesn't mean that you should. And the fight between Superman and Zod should have been better plotted. It's just punch, 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 punch. Very impressive visuals, but punch, 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 punch. Neck snap. And it should have been far better plotted. It should have been Supes is being beaten down by Zod because Zod's adapted, or Superman beats Zod, then Zod adapts and beats Superman, then Superman has a vision of his father or something saying you can be what you choose to be, follow up with the themes that you've been developing through the film, and then Superman, you know, sort of becomes the better fighter because he is able to do things, outthink Zod and outmaneuver Zod in ways that Zod can't think because of his Kryptonian sort of breeding, and then he wins. And that's what it should have been, the final battle, and it wasn't. It was instead a random collection of destruction and you know, smoke and dust and girders. And it ruined the movie for me, really, it did, unfortunately. I can't sit and love it like I want to. I think I would have rather seen Bryan Singer's Superman 4 than Man of Steel, because I think that Superman Returns has, even though the plot is all backwards, I think Superman Returns is a lot more successful as a Superman film than Man of Steel. Although Man of Steel has some marvelous moments. You know, a lot of the shots, a lot of the camera work is beautiful when the camera's attached to the side of a bus going into a river, or we're focusing on a butterfly on a thing. It's beautiful. It's very well shot. It just, again, Zack Snyder, Watchmen problem. He doesn't seem to have the understanding of tone that he should. He doesn't seem, he's got a very strong visual style, a very strong and well-developed idea of visuals, but he doesn't really understand people. And that I think, is his problem. And Christopher Nolan, being as uninvolved as apparently he says he was, shows he should have been more involved. So there we go. World War Z is the next on the list. Brad Pitt's biggest film of all time, monetarily speaking, apparently. It's good. It's an above-average action film. It's an above-average zombie film. It's not the best zombie film ever. It's not going to change the zombie genre forever, like 28 Days Later did, or The Walking Dead is doing at the moment. It's not going to change anything, but it is very good. It works well in the zombie genre. I'm glad they changed the ending from the action hero Moscow ending to the very taut, maze-like Cardiff ending. Interesting to see Peter Capaldi as a WHO doctor. it's good. It's a good film. It keeps you engaged, and it makes you care about Brad Pitt succeeding in his mission. Now You See Me is the next film. Louis Leterrier proving that he's not all that bad. It's a bit far-fetched at times. The cast are all interesting enough and entertaining enough. It's by no means a brilliant film, but it kept me entertained till the end. It's about magicians basically getting revenge on a guy, and then the police are chasing them, and who's ahead of who, and it's like three cats and two mice, and you're not sure if the mice are chasing the cats are chasing the mice, and it does a very good job of doing that, and some of the magic tricks in it are very interesting, and when they explain them, it's like in the old Columbo episodes, when Columbo gets the trick explained to him just before you arrest the guy. It plays like that, it's an interesting thing. It was a entertaining, but not life-changing film. Next up, A Field in England. I'm going to kick myself, I forget the guy's last name. The director of Sightseers basically comes back with another film which is even more bizarre and weird and difficult to get into. I loved Sightseers very much as a dark comedy. This I didn't like as much because it feels a lot more experimental in terms of the narrative. It's set in the English Civil War. It's in black and white. It's set almost entirely in one massive field as this group sort of go over it and round it and look for buried treasure or something. It's very well acted. It's quite well written in terms of the dialogue. Rhys Shearsmith is the sort of the main characters, and he's quite unpleasant while at the same time not being as bad as the bad guy. It's a weird film. It's an interesting film. Again, I want to see more from this guy, but I'm not gonna sit and watch it, every 6 months like I would with The Empire Strikes Back. It's not mainstream bad. It's not mainstream good either. It's just its own thing. It's an experiment worth watching. I think if you love this film, I think it's more about you than it does about the film. But that's maybe me just being very arrogant. I apologise. Scratch that last remark. That is me being very arrogant. Scratch that last remark. All right, next up is Pacific Rim, what seems to be a film adaptation of the Power Rangers or something. It's giant robots versus giant monsters with nary a plot thread between them. The action sequences are fantastic, brilliantly CGI'd monster giant robot battles. The plot is bobbins, the acting is subpar from everyone involved, including Idris Elba. It should have been rewritten from the ground up. Once they'd filmed the robot and monster battle scenes, it should have been rewritten from the ground up. Cut Charlie Hunnam's character completely. Give everyone else proper motivations. Get a proper script around it, basically. It's worth watching with the sound down, with popcorn and beer, basically, is how I put it. Next up, The World's End. The third part of the Cornetto trilogy from Edgar Wright, following on from Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. It is absolutely superb. It lives up to both of those films. It's well written. It's the character drama is phenomenal. I won't say phenomenal, maybe, actually, but it's certainly very, very effective. Very, very interesting. Very, very funny. And when the sci-fi bit kicks off, it's very, very good sci-fi as well. You can see what Edgar Wright has learned from Shaun of the Dead in terms of filming an action sequence. And he's lost none of the wit or edge of Sean or Hot Fuzz. It's not maybe as impactful as Shaun of the Dead, because that was the first really successful British Hollywood-style film from these guys. But it is very, very good. It's very good. Yeah, well worth a watch. The Wolverine comes next. And the Wolverine, for me, and probably less so for Malk, but certainly to some extent for Malk, I'm speaking for him here, fixes a lot of the damage that Origins caused in terms of making Wolverine redeemable as a franchise again. It's not perfect. The last battle is descends into just sort of chameleon banality. It looks like the end of every possible sci-fi film these days. It's hero versus big bad guy in lab. It just doesn't. It's not necessary. We don't need it. We need something better, more original. It's about him in Japan. It needs to be a samurai battle. You need to go to Kurosawa's final battles to really plot the Wolverine's final battle. That's what it needed to be, and it wasn't. And that's the mistake of it. The first sort of 4/5 are really good. Hugh Jackman as Wolverine is always pretty good, but he's in, you know, X-Men / X2 form here. The actors around him are all very, very good. The Japanese setting is beautiful and interesting, and it gives him chance to fight on bullet trains and fight Yakuza and things like that, and that's all very cool. But yeah, the end kind of muddies it a little bit and becomes very sort of samey. But here's hoping that the Wolverine 2, or the sequel to this film, fixes a lot of that as well, and again makes him into a gruff, haunted character who doesn't have to fight giant robots. Okay, next up is Blackfish, a documentary about San Diego SeaWorld and a particular orca killer whale who lived there, who killed three trainers, and the failings and the money-grabbing, cynical corporate evil, essentially, of the organization, which consistently covered up and muddied reports because this killer whale was very valuable for breeding purposes. It's a very harrowing documentary. It makes you want to go and save all the whales. And it makes you sad that the human race is the kind of race that does this to other species. It's horrible to see the way these creatures are treated. It's horrible to see the way that the humans treat each other. It's not going to make you feel good about being a human being, but it's a very effective documentary. Next up, The Conjuring, best horror film of the year. It's from James Wan, who did Insidious and Insidious 2. It's better than both of those. It's really, really effective. The acting is all superb. The child actors are very good. It's creepy. It's scary when the big, scary, shocky moment finally happens. It's a proper tension-building moment rather than just a jump scare. It's got jump scares as well, but it's brilliant. It's everything about horror as it should be done. It's not maybe going to stand up with classics like The Exorcist or The Shining or The Thing, but it is definitely, definitely the best of the year and the best of recent years. And I hope if it does become a long-standing classic, I think it will have earned it. Next up, The Lone Ranger. The Lone Ranger is an absolutely fantastic, almost faultless 90-minute movie with another hour and 10 minutes or thereabouts thrown on top of it. It suffers from the Gore Verbinski, Joel Schumacher, Disney epic attempt. They try and make it this great big epic, and what it really should be is an Indiana Jones-esque or Pirates of the Caribbean 1-esque adventure about a guy who's on a simple quest for revenge, finds a man who's seeking the same, and they don masks and they go and get it. It should have been that. It's overcooked, overblown. Someone needs to take a pair of scissors to it and make a really good film out of it, because it could be really good. I'm ignoring at the moment the fact that Johnny Depp, a white man, has been cast as Tonto, one of the most iconic Native American characters in history, in Hollywood history. Even if he has been kind of bumped up to lead part rather than sidekick, as he used to be, surely there are good Native American actors out there. Although, would this film have got made if they'd have been in it? No, probably not, but still, blah, 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 blah. But no, it's good. It's not the failure it was meant to be. It's a bit like John Carter. It's not as good as John Carter, but it's a bit like John Carter. I think it suffers a little bit from the Disney hype machine, and I think the backlash against it was against the marketing rather than the film. Maybe I'm wrong on that, maybe I'm not, but it seems that way. Because it was effective. Armie Hammer's very good, Johnny Depp's very good, and the moment when that music kicks in fact, there are two moments when it kicks in. One is a sort of a comedy anticlimax right at the beginning, and one is the proper William Tell Overture, and when it does, oh, I defy anyone not to just start jumping up and down in your seat because it's really, really cool. Okay, next up is Kick-Ass 2. It's as good as Kick-Ass 1, not as fresh, not as funny perhaps. It's better than the comic in the same way that Kick-Ass 1 was better than the comic. If you liked Kick-Ass, go and see Kick-Ass 2. If you didn't, don't. It's not going to change the world of comic book movies, but it certainly isn't a failure either. Jim Carrey was very good in it, and again, if you read about sort of surrounding the controversies surrounding his comments when the film came out, ignore all that. It's a good film. It's an enjoyable sort of grindhouse superhero dirty blockbuster. So yeah, go and see it. Elysium by Neil Blomkamp. If it had been by anybody else, this would have been pretty good film, but it's from the guy that gave us District 9, and so it's a big, big disappointment. It looks phenomenally good. He's very good at world building, but it's just not very well written. It doesn't hang together. It doesn't say things about the situations that they're in like it should, like it tries to. As a straight action flick, it's all right, but you know, you don't care about what's going on as much as you should. Matt Damon's fine in it. Charlotte Copley's very good. It's just not what it should have been. It should have been a socio-drama sci-fi again. That's what he kind of looks like he's going for, and it isn't that. And again, if it's an action film, it should have been going more for the action film. His creativity in filmmaking seems stunted by the budget that he was given. They should give him a small budget again and see what he can do with it with a small budget. See what he does when he's forced to. It worries me that Duncan Jones is on the new Warcraft movie because I really, really enjoyed Moon very, very, very much. Source Code was fine, and now he's got a huge budget. Is he going to be able to be as inventive and as good as he was? Are you going to be able to have that slow reveal of a clone when it's not really a twist? It's kind of more, you know, unusual narrative storytelling. Are you going to be able to have that in a World of Warcraft movie? I don't think you are. So it bothers me that they're taking these people who are making phenomenally interesting low-budget indie films and giving them huge budgets, and then they're producing middle-of-the-road, you know, ordinary films. So disappointing. As opposed to the next film, Riddick, which is the unlikely third part of the Pitch Black series. We're back with Riddick yet again. He's back on a planet fighting for his life like Pitch Black rather than in a galaxy, you know, fighting an alien army like Chronicles of Riddick. And it's really good for that. it's not particularly well written. You can see that Vin Diesel's having a lot more fun playing Riddick than he is, you know, studying the role. It's bizarre in certain parts. You know, there's weird bits, and the character sort of interactions are kind of odd. But it's a fun film. It's a fun low budget sci-fi film, and long may they make more. I want to see Richard B. Riddick. I want him to be the iconic cinema sci-fi character that he should be after Pitch Black. And this is a definite step in the right direction. Next up, Ender's Game. It's on the good side of average. I'll put it that way. I don't agree with Orson Scott Card's politics or religion or anti-gay bashing at all. But if you divorce yourself from that and you just focus on the film as an industrial, you know, product of many people's hard work, it's an above average sci-fi epic. It's kind of like Harry Potter meets Starship Troopers. It's not quite so simple to boil down to just that sort of high concept treatment, but it's all right. The kid who played Hugo is Ender, and he's fine. He's not bad. He's not Haley Joel Osment in Sixth Sense good, but he's fine. He's good. He's, you know, he's very good, in fact. Haley Stackfield from True Grit is very good. Harrison Ford's very good. Ben Kingsley, superb. The special effects are very good. The film itself is good. It's a good film. It's not outstanding. It's not amazing. It's not sort of genre defining. But as an adaptation of a classic book, which I haven't read, I have to admit, it seemed absolutely fine. Next up, Thor 2, Thor: The Dark World, to give it its proper name. It was surprisingly very, very good. I don't know what makes Thor 2 very good and makes Ender's Game just good. But there is something. There is something Thor 2 has. Maybe it's a sort of a freedom with the tone. Maybe it's sort of a sense of fun as well as a sense of danger. Maybe it's Tom Hiddleston. I don't know. But Thor 2 is very good. It's not a flawless blockbuster. It's not as good as Iron Man 3, and it's not as good as The Avengers. But it is in that ballpark. It stands proud shoulder to shoulder with the other Marvel movies. Tom Hiddleston's amazing. He's the actor that everyone should be fanboying over, not Benedict Cumberbatch. It's a great film. I love the action. I love the villains, not the head villain played by Chris Eccleston, because he's kind of a lot more boring and sidelined than I thought he should have been. But I love the Thor and Loki quarrels. I love Anthony Hopkins as Odin. I love the fact that Frigga got more screen time this time around. It's brilliant, and I love the sort of the more grimy aspects of Valhalla, not Valhalla, Asgard, that we get this time round. Thanks, possibly in part to the director who worked on Game of Thrones. It looks more medieval-y, which is what I thought Asgard lacked from the first film. If you like, you know by now, it's like the eighth or ninth Marvel film to come out. If you like them, go and see it. If you don't. It's certainly one of the good ones. Next up is Gravity. Now, Gravity is it got so much positive press when it came out, and having seen it, it deserves all of that positive press. It's not my film of the year. It's not my favourite film of the year. It didn't even make the shortlist. It's a very, very taut thriller about a woman trying to survive in an incredibly hostile environment, essentially by herself. And the tension-raising techniques, the tension-creating techniques, both in terms of focusing on Sandra Bullock's face, on the breath, on the edit, on the camera moving when it's free-floating and when it's static, it's a masterclass in tense atmosphere-building filmmaking. It's brilliantly made. In fact, I go as far as to say it's a flawless movie in that sense. And I think if anyone considers themselves in any way interested in film at all, it's a film from 2013 that you have to go and see, or you have to see somehow. It's not my favourite, but that's not to say that I don't think it is utterly flawless, because it is. Okay, next up, The Hunger Games, Catching Fire. Very, very good follow-up to The Hunger Games, which was sort of one of my surprise hits of last year. I didn't expect to like it nearly as much as I did, and I really enjoy it. Having read about the making of the books, Suzanne Collins, who wrote it, was inspired by ancient Rome and the gladiatorial combat, and the fact that the districts are the outlying regions of Rome and they all work hard so that Rome can have luxury. And when you see it in that context, and it becomes sci-fi that both comments on what has been and what may yet to be, it seems more important than just, you know, battle royale for teens. Jennifer Lawrence is phenomenally good. Again, the supporting cast around her is really, really good. There's no real weak link. It ends very abruptly, as does the book, so you can't fault the film for that. It makes you want to see more. It makes you want to know what happens next. It's great. It's very, very good. What I will say is where it doesn't quite work as well as the first Hunger Games is that there's never quite that same sense of threat. Obviously, there are plenty of times when Katniss is in danger for her life, and that's all very well and good. But it's not a sustained threat like in the first Hunger Games, like you're rooting for this person to survive against all the odds. There's less odds against her. The odds are slightly more in her favour in this one. So I'm looking forward to the third one, where that should be rectified if you've read the books. Okay, next up is an odd one, actually. It's a made-for-TV property, or at least, you know, it's a TV property, which was screened in cinemas this year, live broadcast on TV, in 3D, on TV and in cinemas. It's Doctor Who, The Day of the Doctor, the 50th anniversary special of Doctor Who, starring Matt Smith and David Tennant and John Hurt. So if you're not a Doctor Who fan, this might not really sort of make a lot of sense. If you are, then you know, I'm not as big a Doctor Who fan as you, so this might. I'm going to be quite brief with this one if I can. I've always liked Matt Smith since he started on Doctor Who. I never really gelled with David Tennant. And nothing in this film makes me change that opinion. But what I do wish more than anything is that from 2005 to the present day, John Hurt had been the Doctor. He is the best Doctor in a very, very long time. I love Paul McGann, and I'm really excited for Peter Capaldi. And you know, John Hurt just shows both Matt Smith and David Tennant how to play the Doctor. He's phenomenally good. It's a good Doctor Who as well. It's a good story. A lot of modern Doctor Who I find to be packed with good ideas and kind of let down with the actual execution. And maybe older people who've been watching Doctor Who for years and years and years might feel the same. You know, my first Doctor was Sylvester McCoy, so I came into it quite late in the game. But that's how it feels to me in the modern era. And this one didn't do that. This one lived up to the promise. And I like that very much. Okay. On to my last film. Can't believe we've been through 12 months already. I hope I've not gone too fast. I hope I've not rushed over things that people wanted to listen to. If so, please do put a comment on the post or on iTunes. Ask what you want me to talk about again. If you don't want me to talk again, you know, then fine, fair enough. But if you wanna engage in a dialogue, then please do. You can leave a comment at malcolmbenji.blogspot.com. You can email churchofben@gmail.com. Or you can leave a comment on our iTunes page if that's how you listen to us. So without further ado, the last film of the year. I'm gonna spoil my mini review of it right now by saying it has definitely made the shortlist for film of the year. It's a film, it's a sequel, it's based on a book. It's one of the big films of the year, certainly in terms of money and in terms of expectation. And it's a rare sequel which has taken everything that I didn't like about the first one and it has fixed it without changing any of the bits that I liked about the first one. That is The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. I loved this film. I adored it. I saw it, loved it, and I'm going to go and see it again very, very soon. It's phenomenally good. It's brilliant. It does exactly what The Two Towers doesn't. The Two Towers is a five-star film by all, you know, absolutely. But it's arguably the weakest of the trilogy because it doesn't have, you know, sort of the beginnings to enjoy. It doesn't have the ends to wrap up. It's kind of stuck with middle film syndrome. Whereas this film absolutely takes everything that I didn't like about the first film, i.e. the juvenile tone, the massive shift in tone between dark and gritty and juvenile, over reliance on choreography and comic pratfalls, all the sort of the silly stuff basically, when it couldn't decide whether it was a kids film or a Lord of the Rings prequel, and it abolishes that and it becomes almost a straight Lord of the Rings prequel where it takes itself seriously, it takes the world seriously, and it's beautiful. No one has done better at world building since 2001 than Peter Jackson. He created Middle Earth, you know, to such a lavish extent, and he's done the same again with The Hobbit. The costumes, the props, the sets, it all looks stunning. I love the relationship between the dwarves and the elves, where there's kind of like, they're kind of meant to be buddies, but they obviously hate each other. And the elf, Thranduil, who is Legolas's dad, locks up the elves in the dwarves in his dungeon, and then, you know, they're enemies, but they're not enemies, and they are, but they're not, and it's all kind of weird. And there's the orcs chasing them to give them the threat, which, you know, the book is lacking. In the book, it's just a trotting along the hills. In this, they're being chased by someone, so they need to keep going, and that works really well. I love the Lake Town segment where they're trying to escape out of Lake Town. That's all very, very good. And then, you know, after almost a full film of just, you know, much, much improved storytelling and brilliant action. I must admit, though, the action sometimes does still let me down a little bit. It's a bit too CGI. It's a bit too over the top. The barrel chase goes on for a bit too long, and there's too much of the sort of the dwarves being superhuman fighters. In Lord of the Rings, Gimli just sort of hits stuntmen. You know, John Rhys-Davies hits stuntmen with a big rubber foam axe. Do the same again. You know, don't have the dwarves be so balletic. You know, they've got Dwalin throwing an axe, hitting an orc that he couldn't possibly have known was going to be there because he was around the corner, and it just gets a bit too much sometimes. But it's easy to overlook those things if you don't like them, because the rest of it is so good, the acting, the characterization. Martin Freeman, though his part seems to be smaller in this film than it was in the last film, he's still very much a highlight of the film. Him and Ian McKellen, I think, stand out as the absolute pinnacles of what's brilliant about this film. And then you get to the Lonely Mountain. And then you get the last sort of 25 minutes with the dragon. And oh my word, it suddenly becomes the best dragon film ever. Again, when the 13 dwarves come into it, it gets a little bit busy. It's not certainly not flawless for an action sequence, in the same way that perhaps Helm's Deep was in the Two Towers. But it's absolutely riveting. Benedict Cumberbatch is phenomenal as Smaug. Him and Martin Freeman, you know, the CG dragon with Benedict Cumberbatch's wonderful voice versus Martin Freeman makes easily for the best scene in the film. And then when the dwarves come in, it makes for the best action scene of the year, possibly. It's brilliant. It's absolutely wonderful. It's a resounding success from beginning to end. You know, 4.5 stars out of 5, possibly even 5 out of 5. Damn it, you know, forget my gripes, forget my personal dislikes. This is a great film. This is the way blockbusters should be done, with good script, good dialogue, good characterization, and then all the good action put in around it, all the big special effects put in around that. You need a solid foundation of a good story and good acting and all that stuff first, and then you put the special effects in. So The Hobbit 2 really has sort of swept in at the end of 2013 and stolen it for itself in the way that Lord of the Rings did for 3 years on the trot. So there's my films of the year. I'm gonna boil it down now to try and see if I can decide which is my favourite film of the year. I've got Django Unchained. That's definitely one of my films of the year. Lincoln and Zero Dark Thirty I'd like to put up there, but I'm not going to put Lincoln up there, I don't think. Much as I love Lincoln, nor Zero Dark Thirty. Again, stunning film, maybe even flawless like Gravity, but just my own personal taste. I like a bit of sci-fi. I like a bit of fantasy. You know, I like a bit of a bit of something more than real life. Cloud Atlas, I'd definitely put up there. It's not my film of the year, but it's definitely in my top five. So Django and Cloud Atlas so far. Iron Man 3, just because, you know, and then The World's End, The Conjuring, The Hunger Games 2, and The Hobbit 2. I think that's my short list. I'm gonna take out The Hunger Games 2 because I really enjoyed it. I really, really did. But it's a middle film and it has middle film syndrome a little bit. Maybe it doesn't though. Maybe it doesn't. I'm gonna get rid of it because I've still got, you know, a few sequels in there. I've still got Iron Man 3 and The Hobbit 2 in my blockbuster sequel fan favorite bit. So I'm gonna get rid of Hunger Games 2 because I liked Iron Man 3 and The Hobbit 2 more than Hunger Games, even though I liked Hunger Games very, very much. The Conjuring I'm going to get rid of because, again, as a fairly new horror fan compared to being a fan of drama and sci-fi and you know, historical films, horror has not really been a genre I've been interested in until quite recently. If I was a huge horror fan, I'd say The Conjuring is a film of the year, but I'm not, so I'm not. Which takes us down to Django, The World's End, Iron Man 3 and The Hobbit. Okay, I'm going to take out Iron Man 3, and I'm going to take out The Hobbit, because both films were phenomenally good fun, and I'm definitely going to own them and watch them multiple times, but at the end of the day, Django and The World's End, for me, were films where I didn't have anything in them where I didn't really like. So Django Unchained and The World's End, that's where I'm left with for my film of the year. I think I'm gonna. I love Edgar Wright. I love Simon Pegg, and it's a British film. And I should say World's End, but I'm gonna have to go with Django Unchained as my film of the year. I'm gonna have to because it's just so damn cool, and it's Christoph Waltz is effortlessly cool as Dr. King Schultz. Jamie Foxx is amazing as Django, you know, not the best thing in the film, but certainly, you know, one of the best heroes of the year. DiCaprio is phenomenally good. Samuel L. Jackson, I didn't even mention, he's brilliantly funny and sinister and creepy and horrible and amazing all at the same time. It's just a flawless film. It's just amazing. If you can, you know, forgive Tarantino giving Krishnan Gurumurthy a hard time on Channel 4 News, it's an amazing film. So that's going to be my pick of the year, Django Unchained. Right, well, that's me then. Thank you for listening. That's an hour and a quarter of your time, which you've dedicated to listening to my ramblings. Hopefully, if you've seen all those films, you either agree or at least you've been interested in hearing my points of view. If you haven't seen those films, hopefully I've given you some hints and tips on what to see as the DVDs come out over the next wee while. All I can say is that Malcolm Benji will be back in hopefully the very, very near future. And here's looking forward to 2014. I hope it's a good one for you. Thanks. Bye-bye.